exactly. But when I saw the title, I thought that we have some work about bioinformatics, and we think about how to define transcription module. And initially, I thought I'd describe this to you, but then after hearing Andrew Murray, I thought I'll describe another aspect of our work, which has more to do with the modeling, with defining modules, but I only changed part of the talk, so just the first part. And what I'll try to do now today, because I've been given such a long time, is to try to cover three subjects that we work on. And all three of them are concerned with how you can actually go ahead and how can you actually define modules in a system which is really highly connected. So when we think about the cell, we don't think about one particular function. We don't think about one particular set of limited number of proteins, but everything is integrated. Everything is talking to each other. And one of the main questions is how can you really define distinct sets, small subnetworks within this highly connected mess? So what I will do is I will first focus on one particular small network in yeast, which is a MAP-kinase cascade, which functions in both pathways. And this is, I think, is a general scheme in eukaryotic signaling that usually when you have signal transduction, it's not dedicated to just one particular function, but it's many times shared between different pathways. And the question is how specificity is achieved. How can we take, if you want overlapping modules and still preserve their entity, so they will know what they are. And I will give two possible mechanisms about how you can do it. The second aspect I will talk about is how can you define, if you want, functional pathways in the metabolic network. The metabolic network is maybe the examples of a large-scale network that is really highly integrated. All metabolites, many metabolites are connected to each other. And I will show a work that we did about how you can use co-expression analysis to define functional metabolic pathways. And I will also show how you can identify design principles of metabolic regulation. And the last subject that I will talk about, those two subjects are theoretical or computational, or if you want, bioinformatic analysis. The last part, I will describe the experimental results that we have, that we use large-scale gene expression profiling to actually maybe consider one of the questions that Andrew asked. And this is, if you want from one point to another, do you always follow one particular path, or you can get from one point to another by using different paths? And I will actually describe an experiment, which is the sporulation system that Andrew mentioned. And I will show how, using a new or somewhat modified experimental technique, we can try and gain insights into this question and also look at what is usually defined in developmental processes, which is a commitment point, how we can use gene expression profiling to see the genetic definition or genetics underlying the commitment point. So I hope I'll have time to describe this. And the first thing I want to start is with the issue of specificity. So when you think about the signaling pathways in bacteria, usually it's very or relatively simple. This is, for example, a chemotaxis system that I was working on. You have a sensor, which can be a receptor. It's part of it is inside the cell, part of it is outside the cells. It interacts with some signaling protein that transmit the signal to some output. In this case, it's a motor, which needs to change direction. It can also be changes in gene expression, and there are feedbacks. And if you look at bacteria, you have the same paradigm, which is duplicated approximately 50 times. And they are distinct. They are very homologs. So the sensors usually share lots of sequence similarity. The response regulator, for example, KY, also share lots of sequence similarity. But they are distinct. You have a function. You have the signal transduction module, if you want.
50 that use the same KY.
No, it's 50 that have the same paradigm, but each of them has a distinct KY. I don't put my name under 50. I took it from a review. I didn't count them, but that's approximately what is being said.
So, are these 50 different systems, presumably they're also coupled? Or?
They're 50 different functions.
Yeah, but is there any crosstalk?
I'm sure there is crosstalk between the systems, yes. But it's not in the level of sharing a protein. So from the existing knowledge, it looks like each protein is belonging to a specific function. KY functions in chemotaxis, I don't think it functions in any other pathway.
Now,
yeah.
How many bacteria do you find with flagella in the swimming
type of thing? Oh, I'm talking about one particular E. coli. No, okay. So what I meant is that if you just look at E. coli, you have different signaling pathways in E. coli. You have a pathway that this is for the chemotaxis. You have for nitrogen regulation. You have for many other systems, osmoregulation. And each of them has its own unique signaling pathway.
One more question to put on the question I just asked you. In the sense of control theory, you could ask
yeah.
the system is a fully decoupled system or not. Has anybody
yeah.
done any kinds of experiments to?
I'm not the best expert to ask, but from what I know, they are pretty decoupled. There are questions even how you can preserve the decoupling because they are very similar in terms of sequence, but still the kinase this should also only interact with the MC, with the chemotaxis receptor.
Well, what are the input output fence? I was wondering.
Yeah, but I think they are pretty much decoupled. To a large extent, they are decoupled, and even if there is some crosstalk. It's very different than what we see in eukaryotes. So eukaryotic signal pathway cascade, there are several principles that distinguish them from bacteria. One of the things that you find again and again is signaling cascade, where you don't have just a sensor and a response regulator, but you actually have a whole cascade where the input actually activates some kinase, which then go ahead and activate another kinase, et cetera, until only the last kinase activated transcription factor, which generates an output. So there is a signaling cascade. One of the canonic examples is the MAP kinase cascade. Now, there are lots of work about asking what could be the advantages of such cascades. And they were giving few explanations were given. One of them is that it can serve some amplification. When we talk about not becoming a switch, but actually an amplifier, if you have a small input that makes only few of those kinases, and you can have an enzymatic amplification. It's doubtful if this is actually a good explanation.
Is cascade different for each variable pathway, or do they all go to the same lab kind of test?
Right, and maybe the second principle, which I think is fair to call it principle, is that signaling cascades in eukaryotes are not decoupled, or much less decoupled than in bacteria. And in fact, you have limited number of signaling proteins, and there is an iterative use of the same protein components. So you have the same. You have just a limited. If you think about a different MAP kinase cascade, you can have this is just a few examples of what a MAP kinase. You have some of them, but you can have. Many different signals that go through those cascades.
So you said amplification is doubtful. I thought, in fact, that it is sort of already ruled out by Perot's experiments, right?
Maybe it's ruled out, maybe it's not. I think it's questionable because the question is, when you do the experiment, it depends on what regime you do, in what regime you do the experiment, right? If you gave a small enough signal. But I think it's questionable if that's really the reason. But that's definitely one of the explanations that was given for this.
The different
cascade.
Receptors go all converge to the same kinase.
Right, exactly.
Cascade.
Exactly. Or there are a few MAP kinase cascades which integrate lots of signals. Now, in sometimes it's happening in different cell types. And then you can say the context is what determines the functionality of the MAP kinase cascade. But even in the same cell type, in many cases, you have, like I'll give an example for yeast, but it's not just yeast. Also, in other systems, you have the same MAP kinase cascade participating in transducing different signals. And the main question, one of the central questions, is how specificity is achieved, or how can you really preserve this, if you want, modular function of this pathway, even though you share the same signaling component.
I think it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that we really look at in developmental systems with these pathways
yeah.
to cover the whole of that wall, and they're all totally connected.
Not connected?
Interconnected.
Interconnected, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
So that's exactly the question. The question is, can you define a module or can't you define the module? No, I will try. Okay, so the question is, we can think about two different type of mechanism, how this functions. Yes, yeah, sorry.
This is always comes up, and I'm always confused. So the crosstalk is very generic. Generic things should have at least two examples. So what are the two examples?
Okay, I'll give you two examples. One of the examples I will discuss in details very soon is the yeast map kinase cascade. This is one of the canonical examples. We have one map kinase cascade which transduces a mating signal and the invasive growth signal, and also involved in other. This is one of them. The second one that the people usually quote is the PC12 cells. It's cell lines that were taken from rat. And then you have MAP kinase cascade, which control the same MAP kinase cascade, which control both differentiation and proliferation, depending on the signal. So I think those are the two canonical examples. Yeah.
So these cascades are being used at the same time for two different signals, or is it already is this like a pathway that you
okay.
One signal one time and a different signal?
Okay, I will try to relate to this question toward the end of this section of the talk, but it's in the same cell type, okay? So it's not in two different cell types. It's on the same cell. The same cell has a capacity of using this signal to signal mating, or using this pathway to signal mating, and using this pathway to signal invasive growth. The same cell. Now, I'm not saying it's happening at the same time. Actually, I don't think so, but I'm not sure this is the right experiment was done. Yes? Yeah. Okay, I don't want to reject it. I think it depends on what system you look, and I think he showed it very nicely experimentally in his system, in the response to progesterone, that you actually make a switch. Now, it's not clear if it's from the MAP kinase itself or from the positive feedback loop, but definitely in his system, MAP kinase actually make a switch. Now, when you think, however, at the systems that have scaffold, and many of those systems have scaffold that put the proteins together, then this function cannot be achieved. So the question is why you have scaffold and why you have sometimes signaling with the scaffold and why not? I'll try to get into it. But definitely in some system, I mean, he showed it very conclusively that in his system you can get a switch. Okay, so you can think about it in two different ways. One of the ways is really that you have maybe something that maybe resembles what we like to think about like a neural network, but you have many different proteins, they're all connected to each other. You have some different paths, and you have some combinatorial coding. So each stimulus generates some particular combinatorial coding, and then really it's hard to define a module. On the other hand, you can think about a system where actually you don't have a combinatorial coding, but you do have a well-defined path and a dedicated pathway, but those dedicated pathway share components. And I think that this is the view that is favored. And the question is, if this is a view that is favored, or maybe by some, is favored by some, can this really be achieved? Or can we see a mechanism where this be achieved?
This would be sort of a telephone network.
What?
That
would sort of a telephone network. Right, exactly. So that's a question that we wanted to address. Can you functionally insulate signaling pathway, even though they share components? Okay, and we looked at the budding yeast. This is a picture of this is a budding yeast. You see that it divides by budding. This is a mother cell, this is a daughter cell. It's a single cell, and it can live in two types. It can be haploid, or it can be diploid. And yeast also, it's a simplest eukaryote, I think. I think it's fair to say that it's a simplest eukaryote that has a MAP kinase cascade, and in fact, it has five MAP kinase cascade, which signals different inputs. For example, mating, if you have a mating pheromone, you have a MAP kinase cascade, which induces a mating response. If you have salt or sorbitol, you have a different MAP kinase cascade, which induces osmolarity response, nutrient limitation, invasive growth, protein glycolization, cell wall integrity. And there are a few more now. There's a MAP kinase cascade for cell integrity, and there's a MAP kinase another one on top of this, and there's one which is dedicated to sporulation. And I think that what you can see, if you read the name of the protein, each of the name here is the name of one protein, you see that there is a huge overlap. For example, if you think about sterol 11, which is a MAP kinase, we see that it's here, it's here, it's here, and it's here. Steral 7 is here, and it's in three-dose pathway KSS1. Steral 12, I'll go more into it, but this is a very good model system to try to ask this question, because you see already that there is really a huge interaction.
Is there ever an overlap where all three are the same?
What?
Is there ever an overlap in the sense that all three are the same?
I'll get into it. Yes, I'll get in.
And there's only one sideway.
What?
There are no sideways.
No, I don't think so.
Can you put that in the previous?
Sure. This is, by the way, taken from a review. I didn't write it by a...
If two of these signals are given at the same time,
right,
then both will function or to some extent? Or
I'm not sure this experiment was done. There is some inhibition. For example, if you give a high salt or sorbitol, then you inhibit mating, at least for some time. This is known. Now, the signal for invasive growth, it's not 100% defined. I mean, it's known how to generate invasive growth. You put them on a rich media, but it's not clear exactly what is a signal. And it's probably a long process, takes a long time. So I'm not sure. This is a very good question. This is one of the things we're thinking about actually looking at more details, is really what's the interaction in terms of functionality between those two signaling pathways. And it's because it's connected to one of our results. Okay. So like I said, I will focus about the two particular pathways, which is the pathway for mating and the pathway for invasive growth. They are both being generated by haploids, the same cell type. They involve many similar proteins. Yes?
Are these common proteins always present in the cell, or are they carefully regulated and responsible?
Okay, like I said, we talk about the same cell type. It's the same cell. It's a haploid cell. So in this cell, those are present and those are present. The same cell. So they are there. Of course, there is also different regulation where you talk about different cell types. And then the question, maybe you just have different protein that express that there is a different context. Then everything depends on context. But really, we talk about the same cell type.
Now, these proteins, are they part of a complex?
Okay, I'll get to it. They are separate proteins, but they might be part of a bigger complex. Okay, so let me just go into more details. What is the mating response and what is the invasive growth response? So this is a yeast life cycle. Like I told you, it can grow as a haploid. Oh, sorry, it can grow as either a haploid or a diploid. If it's a haploid, it can just divide very happily. If it's a diploid, it can also divide very happily. However, if you take two diploids of the different mating type, you have a haploid of a type A and a haploid of type alpha, you put them next to each other, then they will undergo the process of mating and will make a diploid. Okay? Now, the same haploid, if they are put under the proper conditions, they will become invasive and they will grow in a. They will change the how you call it? They will say, you will look at them and you see that they grow differently. They invasive. Okay, so this is what the mating looks like. If you take a cell type A and cell type alpha, you put them next to each other, they start growing what is called they arrest the cell cycle, they start growing. And then they start growing what is called the shmu toward each other until they fuse. Then the nucleus fuse and they become just one cell. This is the mating. This is what invasive growth looks like. Like I told you, the cells look differently. They start growing in kind of chains. And when you try to wash them, that's the way they usually, you look at them. If you try to wash them, then you do, those are, this is a kind of invasive growth. You have here yeast. Each of these triangles is actually yeast, but only those are undergoing invasive growth. And when you wash the plate, you see that all those are washed away, but those that are actually invasive remain stuck to the plate. So you can really differentiate between what is invasive and what is not invasive. Okay, so what are the signaling pathways that are generating mating and filamentous? They're almost the same, okay? In fact, you have a mating signal, which is pheromone. It activates a MAP kinase cascade, steral 20, steral 11, steral 7, MAP kinase this is not, this is a MAP kinase, and a MAP kinase. Then the MAP kinase activates steral 12, which is a transcription factor. Steral 12 makes a complex, a homodimer, and activates a mating signal, activates the expression of mating genes. Filamentous or invasive growth signals requires mostly the same protein, the same steral 20, steral 11, steral 7. Now here we have two MAP kinases that can actually compensate for each other. So we can have mating whether we have only FAS3 or only KSS1. Both of them are MAP kinases. Here it's probably we just need the KSS1. FAS3 cannot have this functionality. Again, they activate the same transcription factor, steral 12. But now steral 12 forms a complex with another protein, TEC1. And now this complex, steral 12 TEC1, activates the filamentous program. Now, there is one accessory protein, which is actually a scaffold protein, steral 5, which is required only for the mating signal. No, I think this description just emphasizes the problem. I'm still in the process of emphasizing the problem because the solution will be very quick.
But the scaffold is absolutely needed, so that makes a difference.
Exactly, exactly. The scaffold is absolutely needed. Now, just want to make two.
But this description leaves a loophole open for
tutorial
coding. Is it TEC1? So who activates TEC1?
TEC1, I think it's not thought that it needs to be activated.
So where you are?
It's usually around. But actually, what activates it is the steral 12 activates TEC1. Steral 12 TEC1 activates TEC1.
Is that known beyond doubt, or is there?
Yeah, it was shown. It was shown. It's a science paper by Jerry Fink, Madhani and Fink. Ethan Madhani and Jerry Fink. They showed it very nicely that steral 12 TEC1 activates TEC1.
Yeah.
I think that the problem is how come when you give a mating pheromone, you don't activate invasive growth? And when you start the program of invasive growth, you don't activate mating genes? That's the question. Still the same question. Yeah. Why? But TEC1 is always there. Right. This is the output. I can measure activation of genes that are activated by steral 12 TEC1. I can measure the activation. I can measure activation steral 12, steral 12. There is no overlap. You give an invasive signal, you get this one. You give a mating signal, you get the mating program. And that's a question. I'm still in the question part. Yeah.
Invasive signal, you want to only feed into this kind
of state. Right.
Exactly.
That's the first question. How do we know that there is no combinatorial coding? How do we know that there isn't additional pathways? And in fact, there is additional pathway. For example, invasive program doesn't go just by this pathway, but there is additional pathway that is also required for additional program. So maybe this whole thing is really trivial, and only we talk about is the combinatorial coding.
Well,
however,
I thought that this pathway, the second one in isolation, produces a dynamic program. Now you're saying.
Yeah.
There's no experiment that shows that. Maybe there is some.
No, there is. It's enough, I think. I think it's enough. If you give a strong enough signal, you can generate a signal.
What about the deformed complexes? And then
okay, I will get to it.
I will
try to answer to relate to this also. But first, about the question, is it really something which is very trivial? Are we talking something that is really just combinatorial? And we're asking the wrong question. So there are actually experiments where you can generate crosstalk between the pathways, okay? So there are mutations, you can make mutations, and those mutations leads to activation of one signaling pathway when you, okay? So you make a mutation where you give a mating signal and you actually activate invasive genes, okay? So those are very important mutations for us because it tells us that if there wasn't this mechanism that prevents a crosstalk was possibly is possible, okay? And those mutations are deletion in a gene which is called FAS3, which is a MAP kinase. And when you delete this is just FRELAX-Z is a reporter for the invasive program. You can think about it as an invasive gene. It is activated when you go to invasive, to situation of invasive, okay? You can see it, so it's a reporter. And you see that in the wild type, when you add the pheromone, there is no activation of this FRELAX-Z. There is a strong activation of the reporter for mating gene, which is a peer. It's this one. FUS1 LOXI, exactly. FUS1 is a mating gene. It's to do with the fusion. You give a mating signal, you see a strong activation of FUS1. That's in wild type. However, when you look at cells that are delta FAS3, so they don't have the MAP kinase, now you see something different. Now you see activation of both the PRE. This is the closed buzz of both the PRE and the FRE. Okay? So for us, this observation is extremely important because it tells us that potentially you can get crosstalk between the pathways, even though you don't get it normally. And the question is why you don't get it normally.
The signals in the two slides back, so don't go back. We don't need to. The signals at the top.
Yeah.
It's very naive to just say there is a signal. Obviously, the same system, the system can react very differently depending on what actual signal you bring in. Are we really talking about the same step signal, the same amount of time?
They're not very well defined. I don't think they're defined to that extent. Like I said, the invasive signal is not completely defined. You don't know exactly what generates it. You know that you have to put them in a rich media. The mating signal is just adding a pheromone. And actually, the mating signal you see very quickly. You look at the plus one, you see it in 10 minutes.
So there's no mystery whatsoever. If the signals are slightly different than you're putting in into the system, then obviously you can go into different steady states. You can do all kinds of different things.
So that's exactly the question, how? Okay, but how? Okay. So this is just another demonstration where you can actually generate a crosstalk, but I'll skip it. Okay, so how is it usually? What was the explanation until, I think, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? So there is the issue of a scaffold. There is one protein which is called steral5, and steral5 is required only for the mating. And steral5 is not just a protein that is involved, but steral5 is known to bind most of the proteins in the cascade. It binds steral11, it binds steral5, steral7, it binds FAS3, and it also binds to the receptor that senses the pheromone. So, on the contrast, it's not required for the process of invasion. So, the explanation that was given was the following. So, when you're giving a pheromone, you actually talk to the complex. Okay? You have a complex here, which is whatever binds to steral5. FAS3 has a high affinity to steral5. So you create a complex that has FAS3 bound here. And then FAS3 activated by this complex go ahead and preferentially activates this dimer, steral12. Steral5 associated with the pheromone receptor, and that's how the signal is transduced. Now, for the invasive response, there was no scaffold that was identified, but it was implied that there is a scaffold. Now, the way that the FAS3 deletion was explained was that in the absence of FAS3, KSS1 acts as an imposer, comes instead of FAS3. And now you activate KSS1 in this complex, and KSS1 can activate both processes. What?
Is there any way to visualize more effective?
Exactly. That's the next question. Yeah, of course you can, right? What you can do is, this is just another view of this. You see steral5 binds to the receptor, and then it activates preferentially FAS3. And only in the absence of FAS3, KSS1 acts as an imposer. While at low nutrient, there is a different scaffold which was never identified. And this scaffold binds preferentially KSS1. Now, there's, of course, one prediction to this model. And this prediction is that if you look at the phosphorylation state of FAS3 and KSS1, then in wild-type situation, only FAS3 will be phosphorylated. While when you give mating pheromone, while in the absence of FAS3, you'll see phosphorylation of KSS1, and also when you provide a low nutrient or it's actually rich media for invasive, you'll see phosphorylation of KSS1. But in the original paper, where those mutations were described, this particular experiment wasn't done. But obviously, this is the next experiment. This is, the, if you want, the first prediction of the model. Yes? Sterol 20? Right. I think, I'm not sure, but I think it interacts with the complex. Okay. Okay.
But it still doesn't explain because well, the tech one, if it is considered constitutively activated, why don't we now activate the mutation?
Okay, so the idea was that somehow you have a preferential to the complex. So you can think about it as having a predefined complex, sterol 12, sterol 12, or sterol 12, tech 1. FAST3 recognize sterol 12, sterol 12. And KSS1 recognize sterol 12, tech 1. I think that's the explanation that was given. Exactly. Exactly. Even though I don't think that, that different phosphorylation sites were identified. Yeah, and also, okay, it's equal.
So the complex cannot be extracted, it's not being extracted.
What? No, the complex, I think it's pretty well established that there is a complex. I don't think it was extracted, but all the interactions were actually shown. And it's...
Because if there is a complex involving the same one, but
right, exactly. And right, so then there is no question. But like I said, there is a clear prediction of this model, and this prediction concerns with the phosphorylation set of the protein. So the prediction is that when you give pheromone, only FAST3 will be phosphorylated. In the condition of invasive growth, only KSS1 will be phosphorylated. That's the prediction. And in the absence of FAST3, KSS1 will be phosphorylated. So, like I said, in the original paper, this wasn't addressed. However, in December 2001, there came another paper, Molecular Cell from the lab of Lee Bardwell, which actually measured this. And they used antibody that recognized specifically the activated form of MAP kinase. And those antibodies react both with the phosphorylated KSS1 and with the phosphorylated FAST3. And then they added pheromone. And what they showed, they took time course. So they added pheromone in time zero, and they looked at the phosphorylation state of both proteins. And what they actually showed is that KSS1 and FAST3 are both becoming phosphorylated. That's the first observation. And the second observation was that this phosphorylation is transient. And it practically disappears. It depends how much you give. It can disappear either after 2 hours or 4 hours. Depends how much you give. Actually, it's interesting that if you give more, then phosphorylation decays more rapidly. Okay, this is one of the things that they actually observed. Excuse me? If you give more pheromone, you give a higher dose of pheromone, you activate the signal pathway strongly, more strongly, then the feedback, the phosphorylation is lost faster.
Get a bigger signal faster.
Exactly. But what is shown here is that both proteins are becoming activated. You give a mating signal, it's a wild type background, but both of them are activated, both KSS1 and FAST3. Also, in physiological mating, they simply took A and alpha, mixed them together, measured the phosphorylation of both KSS1 and FAST3. Both are becoming phosphorylated. So this is this is against the prediction of this model. Now the question is, what is happening in the FAST3 deletion? This is a deletion that you actually have mixing. And what is seen here, one option would be, so this is again wild type. Here you see that the transient is even more transient than I showed before. But like I said, it's a different dose that was given to the cell, different dose of pheromone. And what you see here, in the delta fast 3, you see that the signal is not transient anymore. You see approximately maybe a little stronger activation of KSS1, but KSS1 is becoming phosphorylated, and now it's not transient, but is persistent. Yeah. There is some phosphatase that are working there. I don't remember the name. It's known which phosphatase. Oh, there is definitely a regulation here. And the regulation is depending, exactly. The regulation is depending actually on FAST3. FAST3 is regulating this. This is known also before. FAST3 is actually regulating something which inhibits a signal. So what you see here is that actually the deletion of FAST3 leads to a persistent activation. But KSS1 is activated under both cases, both when you give pheromone, when you have invasive, KSS1 is activated. So there is some problem with the scaffold.
You start with the scaffold that may have FAST3 and KSS1, and as the pheromone activates, it simply displaces the equilibrium. And you end up with, after a while, you end up with only
FAST3.
FAST3.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like that, right? Because if that was the case, you would expect to have a longer activation of FAST3. And if anything, you see longer activation of KSS1.
Or the opposite. Anyway, the idea is that once you have the pheromone, you sterilize one form.
No, but the issue is that FAST3 has to become phosphorylated and has to go to the nucleus. The MAP kinase has to leave the complex and go to the nucleus. The activation of sterol 12 doesn't happen on the complex. So it has to become phosphorylated. But in any case, it has to be phosphorylated, even if it's something. Okay, so up to here, it's just setting up the problem. Because I think it's a general problem. And even if what I'll say from now is not true, or maybe it's partially true, just one suggestion, I think this is a really important, interesting problem, how this can actually be done. And it's directly connected to the definition of the module. You have a signaling pathway, two distinct signaling pathways, share component, and yet you can generate different signals. OK. Excuse me? Yeah. Right. Right. Now it was actually shown. So there are two types of experiments. The experiments that are being made to bring out all these results were done not with the actual target, but with a reporter. So there is what is called an FRE-LAC-Z reporter. It's an FRE. It's a sequence which is upstream in the TEC1 gene and in the TY genes that are known to be activated during invasive growth. And it serves as a reporter. And this reporter is not activated by mating. Unless. Now, there were a couple of genome-wide expression data experiments which measured genome-wide expression profiles. And they measured the... They looked what happened in delta FAST3, delta KSS1, and they couldn't see any difference. But they were looking, we think, in the wrong time scale, so looking 30 minutes instead of them. But this is done just with the reporter. Okay, so how can we explain this? Now you see that there are two issues here. There is the issue of the cascade, and there is also the issue of the transcription factor, and the transcription factor. It's the same transcription factor. So not only using the same MAP kinase cascade, you're also using the same transcription factor. And the question is why. And if you want, maybe the canonical description of this is that sterol 12 becoming sterol 12 and becoming activated, and then it can either undergo into a complex and can become either a homodimer or a heterodimer. Okay, so anyone has a suggestion how this can occur, can actually happen? What? It's one aspect of it is a phosphorylation. Yeah.
And there's multiple sites of phosphorylation.
Yeah, it could be a different site. However, if we activate the same kinases, the same up kinases, then how would you have a different site? However, if you just look at this is this really simplified scheme. So what I described to you is really something that a graduate student that is actually the physicist graduate student, is not my student, is working with Daniel Kandel, now with Joel Stavans. He came up with this idea. He said, well, look what's happening here. We have something that has a homodimer, something that has a heterodimer. Homodimer, if you have the rate of formation of a homodimer goes like the square of the activated sterile 12. The rate of formation of here is linear, okay? So if you think about the number of the activated sterile 12 as x, this goes like x squared, this goes like x. So this will win when we have a very fast and high activation. So if all sterile 12 will become activated at once, we have lots of activated sterile 12, this will win. It will all go here. However, if you have a slow activation and each time we only have a small level of activated sterile 12, then the linear term will win because we have x squared, we have x here, right? So it turned out that this explanation can really, you can do all the simulation, write down the full equation, and it's sufficient. Okay? This is one explanation.
So there are ranges then where they will both be comparable.
Exactly. No, I don't think so. But I'll get to it once. So this is one explanation.
Sorry, but this goes back to what I was asking before about whether you're putting the same kinds of signals, right? Because if you put different kinds of signals, that's exactly
right.
What you expect to have.
Exactly. And then there's the question, how can you guarantee that this will be slow and the other one will be fast? Okay. I'll get to the, so this is one operation, and let me show you how we think this really happens, okay? So what we want to do is we want to have a rapid activation of sterile 12 when you have a mating signal, and a slow activation of sterile 12 when you have an invasive signal. Now, how do we think this happens? And we think that this is exactly where the scaffold is coming to play, okay? Because, like I told you, there is a scaffold that functions in the mating signal. Now, what is a scaffold? A scaffold is something that takes and puts all the proteins together. When all the proteins together, they are ready for the signaling, you put them in the right, facing each other, then you can really generate the signal very quickly. Compare this to something that you have here. You have to go from one to another, and maybe it's not so efficient. So you have a way of taking something which is not so efficient and slow. Just by putting a scaffold, you can make it much more efficient. So because you have a scaffold, you can have a rapid activation of sterile 12, have this x squared term wins. On the other hand, when you don't have a scaffold, you have a gradual activation, and you have this. Now, we think that this is not the whole story. We think that there's another mechanism that functions here. Now, I think this is really in biology. From all the examples that I looked at in biology, you never have one explanation for a mechanism. You always have layers. And another mechanism that may function here is, like I said, when you activate the mating signal, one of the genes that's being induced is actually TEC1. Okay? And when you give the invasive signal, TEC1 is under the control of sterile 12 TEC1. Okay? So when you give the invasive signal, even though it's gradual, you have additional transcription of TEC1, and you have feedback which actually increase the importance of this complex, sterile 12 TEC1, compared to the sterile 12 sterile 12. So what we think is happening here really is that you have, and you can do the simulation and it works very well. You see that this is a simulation that is based on everything which is known. You see that you have, when you give a mating signal, which means the only difference in the simulation between mating pathway and invasive pathway is that in one we have a scaffold, so all the rates in the cascade are very fast. And when we have just invasive, we don't have a scaffold, so the rates of the cascades are much slower. And you see that when you have this fast, you can see that sterile 12 activated becomes fully in the complex, and you hardly have any sterile 12 TEC1. And when you have when the inverse is true, when you have sterile 12, when you don't have a scaffold, then you have everything goes to sterile 12 TEC1, and you don't have sterile 12 sterile 12. I can give you all the details. I mean, it's just a differential equation model, and all it's doing is just taking. I only took one. I only took one phosphorylation site, one phosphorylation site for each of the protein, but you can do it too, it doesn't matter. And in fact, what I want to mention here again is that you can generate these curves by looking at, like I said, there are two models that we think that function here. There are two mechanisms. One mechanism is this linear versus homodimer versus heterodimer, and another mechanism is the feedback of tech one, and both can generate similar curves. I only bought these curves because I was thinking, I thought I'm talking about something else. So, but you can actually see this. Yeah, so.
In that model, you're discovering the scaffold for the invasive pathway that destroys the model.
I think so, yeah.
would you get the same effect if you had positive feedback in the pheromone pathway and not in the invasive pathway that goes down the scaffold?
If you have a positive feedback, so the problem is that positive feedback takes a long time to be initiated. I think it might. Yeah.
For example, if plus three did something to activate the pheromone.
Right. What we talk about is not the extent of activation, but more about the speed of activation. We need that the MAP kinase will be activated very rapidly. We need to get full activation very rapidly. If you could generate this by positive feedback, that's fine. Yeah, you can do that, right, I guess. Yeah, you can do that. The absence of scaffold. Yeah.
To make this quantitative plot, you would need to know the spectral interaction and the
spectral. Exactly, yeah.
So these things
have
been measured?
No, not, I don't think many things here have been measured. There is also one thing which is very important here. You see the way one of the crucial assumptions that I make here is that sterile 12 is first becoming activated and then makes a complex, okay? Now, if it would be the opposite, if you had the complexes first and then activate the complexes, this wouldn't work, okay? So this is something that should be measured. This is a prediction of the model, and this should be measured. We're thinking of doing that.
So what
it's not trivial. What?
What
did I do? I just took this... I took this and I can show you all the equations. I took this and made an equation out of them. I have to make assumptions about the rate constant. So you can actually solve the model and see what are the conditions on the rate constant. It's pretty robust. You have lots of freedom, but you do need to keep some relationships. You need some things to go fast and faster than the other. But you can solve all this. Tell you the truth, I don't remember everything precisely. I was preparing something.
Sorry, that's actually another question that I've been trying to also get to answer. So nobody really seems to know how much of a clue what the rate constants are.
Unfortunately, but I think it's being measured, so
well,
hopefully soon we'll know.
So what I really want to understand is if you do a robustness analysis, okay, we have these two bases of attraction that correspond to these two kinds of behaviors, but have you observed other kinds of things too that do not make biological sense? Can you tell us more about that?
I'm not sure I can answer this question. We need a separation of time scales. If we have an intermediate time scale, it won't work, then they will get cross activation. We need a separation of time scales. We need that the scaffold you really make everything much more efficient. It's essential, yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So this was actually being done. And Rosetta's paper where they did the genome-wide expression analysis, they also had a very small level of alpha factor, and they showed that the cells become invasive. But it's not clear. They're not sure that it's the same invasive. They don't say that it's not the same invasive. It's not, but they said that maybe it's because the cells grow schmooze, and maybe it's not what we think about invasive here is what they showed over there. But they actually show that you put a low level of signal and this a very low level of alpha factor, and then and the cells become invasive. So this is of course in support here. Yeah. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Is this a dynamic property that the rapid photographic growth that gets frozen into place one on
exactly.
The other? Exactly. Or is this a question of higher concentration rate?
No, it's a dynamic. It's dynamic. No, no, we just you only have to assume it's that the complexes are very stable. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the following true? If you fix all the parameters, whatever you put out of the hat from, it doesn't matter, and then you only change, you only do a scaling model, one scalar model, so time scale.
Right.
And you look at sort of the asymptotic machines that you would get at the plants, is that what we saw in that picture? Just with one parameter, you get just changing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you get those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a transcription factor. Yeah, it's nuclear.
I suppose what puzzles me is why in C, although it's time, why the blue one doesn't ever have that high peak that you see in second.
But you see here?
That's a gap.
Because this is a dimer and this is a heteromer.
I understand, but so if we look at the very left hand end, it should have gone up and then come down. Am I being different?
No, I don't think it should.
You understand, in the first 5 seconds, still 12 goes up to a very high peak.
No, this is different signals. This is a signal for mating, and this is a signal for invasive. This is a signal that you have a scaffold.
I understand that, but in both cases, you're still getting some of those things there.
Just a little bit, yeah.
If the concentration is so low, you never get to die.
Maybe we can talk later. I can try to explain more. Now, just want to emphasize that this is one mechanism. We now know that there is at least one more mechanism that can generate similar behavior through the feedback of TEC1. And what we think is, and we can actually even show in the theoretically, is that those two mechanisms are beneficial in two different regimes. So, like I said, here I need three orders of magnitude difference in the rate of activation. And if you add the feedback, it really helps you. So we think that there are two regimes, and each of the mechanisms could be beneficial. Each of them could function separately, but together they really extend the parameter regime where it actually works.
I'm sorry, I lost something here. Is there a graph somewhere here that I'm supposed to see of state 12 by itself, since you said it was sort of...
No, I don't show it here. I don't show it here.
So could you give us an idea maybe on the board what that time regime would look like?
It looks more or less like this.
The
matings. This is the map kinase, activated map kinase.
But this was the, so this is what's coming, this is at the map K level.
It's the same. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand the important work there. So the question was that two really different pathways, the elements, and how can this happen?
Right.
Now, what you're saying now is that it's actually not the same pathways.
Exactly. But you can distinguish between pathway based on kinetics. But the kinetic can be used to define modules.
The question is the paradox comes way only for not only but mainly because we are used to run these errors, either the error is there or not.
Exactly.
How long does it take on the model for itself to reset over the heterodimers of the homodimers to associate where it's able to send another signal again? Because according to this, it's frozen.
No. Okay. It's. I don't want to get into it because it's outside this. But you can talk about it later. You have the feedback, and you can when you close the signal, it's closed right away, and it's working. We can talk about it later. I just want to maybe have time to talk about the other things.
It's not activated,
it's exactly, it's associated.
One question, essentially, it's kinetic, right? I mean, for inquiry, there's two different configurations.
exactly. Well, it is kinetics because it's...
Well, you built it around a kinetic framework. You could imagine that two different inputs, one ends up with a very high level of sterility and one with a very
yeah.
level.
Yeah.
The first favors some stable state that is formed
right.
versus feedback and
the other form heterodyne. Yeah, for sure. Yes, it's true. It's not necessarily kinetics. It can also be just a strength. Yeah.
Cells that encounter pheromone very gradually, which is how you might expect them to do it. Colonies of two different mating types.
Yeah.
Never
again, I understand.
Well, your model works because you presumably apply some step increase in the pheromone.
Right,
so
yeah.
Rapid activation.
Yeah.
Biologically, what happens is cells gradually approach each other.
Right.
Right, and it won't go up like that.
Well, but I think they sense the signals right away, right? I mean, they don't need to make the shmoo to sense a signal.
No, but what I'm saying is, imagine two colonies, A and alpha cells.
Right.
And they grow, right? And they start out far away.
Right.
And you can demonstrate that they can sense each other's presence.
Right.
Gradually, as they get close to each other, the pheromone concentration will rise very gradually, right?
Right.
And I think for your model to work, there's a way of making it work. You have to redo things in every cell cycle. That this response, the whole system gets reset every time you appear in G1, because then you're actually sampling the pheromone concentration periodically rather than continuously. Because I think if you sense it continuously,
yeah.
and you just do it by cells, colonies of cells growing towards each other, you'll force them into the invasive path, right?
Well, it depends how fast it goes. I'm not sure. If it doesn't have to be a step function.
No,
if it goes on the time scales of 10 minutes,
right.
I think then the last...
But they're always going to start detecting it at the lowest possible concentration. It's going to increase slowly.
Yeah, but the low concentration should be persistent to see to get invasive.
Right, but it will be persistent.
Okay, so we have to think about this.
Override, you know, okay. You turn on a beta pheromone.
Exactly.
You say, oh, I'm just going to pile up, you know, activated.
Yeah. Exactly, except that there's one very interesting thing here that you should notice, is that if you give mating pheromone, then it will not be able to sense invasive. However, if it's already started the program of invasive, then the inverse is true. It cannot sense mating pheromone.
Is that an observation?
Well, I don't know. It's not an observation. I don't think it was measured. But it's an outcome of the module. Exactly. But what we think is, I mean, one of the questions that you could ask is, why do you have this overlap? Why do you have why do they use the same proteins? I mean, bacteria doesn't do that. Does it give an advantage, or is it just an evolutionary accident? So one of the things that came out, one possibility, is that it allows you to actually introduce competition in the process of computation. So if you started doing invasive growth, you don't want to start doing mating, OK? If you start doing mating, then you don't want to be mating. For example, you have to stop in G1 invasive. You have to keep dividing. So you want, if you think about the PC12 cells, then you have to make a decision: do you want to differentiate or do you want to proliferate?
But here, there's no need to do that. I thought Andrew had a good suggestion: if you have very low levels of mating pheromone and not near the rest of the colony, you better do invasive growth to get closer to the rest of the colony.
Right.
Maybe there's a physiological explanation where you do want to turn on invasive growth.
That's true. So that should be measured.
That's a reason why
you're exactly. That should
why
be. Yeah. Okay. So that should be measured.
Then
that's.
You have to have some state where you
can
reset.
Reset. Okay. And then it will work. Okay. Okay. Good. Right. Exactly. You can reset and switch. Exactly. Because you use sterile 12. You execute a source. If all sterile 12 goes to the mating, then at least for some time.
So you have all sorts of intermediate concentrations there.
Yeah, but.
And you have to say that there's some sort of feedback acting to enhance on the time scale of transcription.
Right, right. But at least immediately, that's what happens. That's the question, where you send the flux of sterile 12? Do you send it to the mating or you send it to the invasive? But I think that what it gives a general way of actually controlling the flow in the pathway based on the kinetics or based on the strength. If it's really relevant and it's consistent with most of the observation for the mating. Like I said, it's not the only mechanism. There is another mechanism which is also consistent, so we think they work together. But we still think that there is, it suggests lots of experiments that can be done to actually test to see if it's true for this system. Okay. So. I don't think so. Yeah, I think it will be inconsistent with our model, because our model actually predicts that there won't be a scaffold, because you want to keep one of them slow and one of them fast. Now, if there is, then we have to deal with it, change the model. But
even if there is a scaffold, it
might be slow. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the criticisms. I don't see how. Yeah. Okay, yeah, it could be. Okay, I want, I go till 12:30, Boris?
Sorry, okay. I don't understand a little bit of the previous question. I mean, you could certainly have three different types of steady states with three different, you know,
Yeah, I mean,
three each.
Yeah.
But you already, you could have conversation.
Okay, I want to.
Lower the level of take one, then you, yeah. Then you may enter into postdoc.
If you increase it. It depends on what.
The filamentous regime, then you could.
Exactly, it's, yeah, that's right. You're right. You're right, yes. Yes.
This has been done? Or?
No. There are lots of experiments. We're thinking about some experiments to do here, but hopefully next time I'll also be able to show experimental results for that, but not. That's more complicated, but there are lots of. Okay, I want to talk about two other, if I have time, but two other subjects that we work about in the lab also has to do with modules. And the first one is to look now, so we looked at a very small defined subset, small network. I want to shift gear and talk for a little bit about really a large network, a very large and a very highly connected network. Now, our approach here is different. This is a metabolic network. So what is a metabolic network? It's really becoming very, many people becoming interested in the metabolic network. With all this genome project, you can very easily just do sequence comparison and find all the enzymes in most organisms and generate a network. And the way usually people look at it is you can think about a metabolite. A metabolite can be thought of as a node in this network. And an enzyme connects to metabolite if there is a reaction that takes us to metabolite. Take, for example, this metabolite to this metabolite, so those two metabolites are connected. And there are several papers that came out that looked at this network. Just look at the metabolites, look at the connection, and try to identify what they call topological, general topological or structural properties in this network. And one of the results of this analysis is that, and I think this is very well realized, that this network is extremely highly connected. So for example, if you, one of the things that people were looking at, in particular the group of Barabasi, is what is the connectivity distribution. So what they do is they take each node, each substrate, and they count how many connections it has, how many metabolites is it connected to. And then they plot the distribution. And you see that this distribution, it's a power law.
What? One is the left.
Here, this is the probability of finding a particular K, and this is a K. I guess this is 1, and this is 100. This is a, right? I'm sorry, I didn't keep it. K is, I think, both. It's either. Two separate. Yeah, you're right. In degree and out degree. Thank you. Thank you. So this distribution is very interesting because it has lots of implication about the network. And they found it for all 43 species they looked at.
It's highly connected because if I go to 100 versus 1, there is a 5 orders of magnitude difference.
Right. But what you have to compare it to, you have to compare it to what you expect from a random network. In a random network, the probability of getting a high level of K, high degree, goes down exponentially, both in a random network and in a modular network. So when you have a modular network that everything is connected, just you have modules, right, that are loosely connected between them, then again, the probability of getting high K just goes down exponentially. So If you have, that's what you should compare it to.
What's the theory for modular networks? I mean, I don't know. I know the random one. What's the modular
network? I don't think it's a theory, but if you have a typical, if you have a, everything is modules and the connectivity is just the size of the module.
Well,
right, the typical connectivity. And then you have noise, and the noise goes exponentially. That's what I mean. So it's not a theory, just a simple observation.
What's the power law? It's about what?
Do you remember what the power law 2, I think, 2 point something? I don't remember the power law. But for all metabolic network, it's more or less the same power law. Yeah, the same exponent. That's enzymes. And this is the symbol for the enzyme. This is the enzyme. It's just a connection, and this is a reaction. This is a substrate. The reaction, and this is the enzyme that corresponds to this reaction. Yeah, just the name of the enzyme. Okay, so that's a network, and it's highly connected. However, and this is just to show you that how connected it is. however. I mean, everyone that worked in metabolism know that metabolic pathways are defined. I mean, people define them. And you know that substrate really flow in particular directions, and those directions are extremely well controlled. There was a very beautiful experiment recently that showed that you can really adapt to optimality, that really the network, the metabolic network really changes itself to be optimal. So it's really, on one hand, something is very connected. It looks like there are so many junctions, the substrate can go anywhere. But on the other hand, there's really very nice routing of the metabolic flow in particular directions. So the question is, how can it be done?
So what do you mean by optimal?
It means, No, I'll tell you exactly what it means. You can take the metabolic network. This is work. I'm sorry. I'm really ashamed. I forgot the name. What? Paulson. Right. You can take the metabolic network and actually calculate the optimal flux. The optimal flux that will give you generates the fastest increase in biomass, and then when you calculate the properties of this optimal flux, I never did this. I'm just reporting what they said. Then you can see relationship between particular, let's say, the rate of uptake of the carbon source and the rate of oxygen uptake should be related in one particular way. And you can see that bacteria actually do that, and if they don't, they evolve toward that. So
what you're saying is not that actually looking inside the black box, you see things that are in some sense optimal, which is
no.
You look at biology.
No. Exactly. I think that there are two observations here. On one hand, we see this huge network that is all connected, and in principle, you have huge, it's like a very, very complicated roadways, and everything can go anywhere. On the other hand, really, you have a very well-controlled flux. So the question is, how do you do that? Now, I think... Right, this is true. But you didn't do that.
Again.
I don't know about the theory like that. There's a theory about how power law evolved, but it's a general theory. What they say is that if you have an enzyme that is highly connected, it's more probable that this enzyme will be also connected to something else. But I don't want to get into this now. But I want to go into this, and how can you take such a complicated network and then still regulate it? Now, I think biologically, all the genome-wide experiments that they're doing preferably show that at least one of the ways of regulating this network is really by changing the availability of connection. So what people are usually doing when they analyze those properties of metabolic network is that they look at everything that is available. You take all the connections and you start analyzing them. However, in practice, only some of the connections available are under any condition. You have really very strict context-dependent regulation. If you take yeast cells and you grow them and you make the dioxic shift, they finish the glucose and they start using the ethanol, you see really very major changes in gene expression, which means that you took some connections and you removed them, and you took other connections and you made them. And the question that we were asking, can you now take the structural information and build on top of it, use co-expression analysis to see which are the functional pathways? And if you can identify general design principles or general principles about those pathways. So the first thing that we did is, you know, it's very convenient to work with metabolic pathways because you have lots of databases. So one of the databases that we used is the KEG. The database that we used is the KEG database. You have the information about the metabolic pathways of all organisms. And the first question that we ask, it's known that genes that are functionally linked are also co-expressed. The first question that we ask, can you really see this when you take data from KEG? Okay, I just want to say something before that. The databases that we use for this analysis is the first definition of reaction, metabolic enzymes, and metabolic pathways using KEG. And for the co-expression analysis, we assembled a very large database of genome-wide expression profiles. We have over 1,000. Now we have about 1,200. It's all publicly available. We just collected it from very many different sources, and that's what we work with. So it's a very diverse set. We have all the Rosetta deletion mutants, profile of deletion mutants. We have stress, environmental stress. We have lots of things. So we use this to identify co-expression analysis and the definition of the pathways, at least initially from KEG. So we took all these pathways, and here we show the average correlation between genes of particular pathway, and this is random control. And you see that there is a bias, even though it's not precise. So it looks like metabolic pathways are at least tend to be co-regulated. Genes of the same metabolic pathway at least has tendency to be co-regulated. And we also observed when looking at individual pathway that in many cases we see transcription factors are also regulated with the genes that they are regulated in the metabolic pathway. You saw at least 7 examples like that. Transporters that transport metabolites that are required by the pathway are also co-regulated with the pathway. There's the feeder pathways, feeder genes that are also regulated with the pathway. So at least on itself, it looks good.
But this must be the now, part that are loosely connected.
What?
I guess in the pathway, this must be the parts that are loosely connected.
That are not co-regulated?
The parts which are co-regulated must be the parts that are loosely connected to the rest.
Why?
But because if they are connected to many other pathways, then you are co-regulated.
Right. Okay. So we looked to see which one are co-regulated. This is an example of what a pathway looks like. This is an example of glycolysis. This is what it looks like, and it has the co-glycolysis and also things around it. And when you look, so it's not 100% defined. Also, there are many genes here that are put by homology. They weren't shown biochemically to be connected to the pathway. Now, only part of these genes, of these enzymes, are actually co-regulated. And when you look at this part, now you see that usually it forms a linear pathway. And actually, in the case of glycolysis, it's all the genes that are, in fact, glycolytic genes that are actually co-regulated. So it's not the preferential where you see the co-regulation, but actually in the core. And this is consistent. So the first question that we ask, if we take co-expression as one way of defining functional pathway, and we have this hypothesis that genes that are actually, when you have a functional pathway, something that really something flows through, then you really have, then they are really co-expressed, then now we can look at junction points, and we ask, really, we have lots, just looking at structure, we have lots of junction points. How many of those junctions, in fact, survive when you look at co-expression? So we can think about a junction like that. We call it a three-point junction. So we have a substrate. This is a metabolite. And we have an enzyme that produces this metabolite. And we have two enzymes that use this metabolite. And now we can look at the co-expression or the correlation between an enzyme here and an enzyme here, an enzyme here and an enzyme here. And we can think about a different scenario. We have a scenario where all of them are co-regulated, and we have a relatively loose definition of what co-regulated is. We ask that over all the 1,200 conditions that we have, we want correlation of over 0.25. So we can think about four situations. Either they're all co-regulated, either, I'll skip this for a second, either we have something that goes in one direction, so we have this enzyme correlated with this one, but this enzyme is not correlated with them, or we can have a situation where none of them is co-regulated. This situation refers to the fact where you have two isozymes that function that can actually catalyze the same reaction, and we find one metabolite correlated with one side of the junction, and the other isozyme is correlated with the second part of the junction. Oh, what did I do here? I'm sorry, 1 second. I skipped. Okay. So you can just take all the junctions that you have in the network and try to classify them according to these rules. And this is a situation where we couldn't classify. There's some part which you couldn't classify. They were unclassifiable, at least by us. And what you see is that you see that most of the junctions, actually, we don't find any correlation. Most of the ones that we find correlation, they're actually this type, type C. There is some which are class B, and there is also only a very small part that are actually size A. So it looks like when you think about co-regulation really favors linear flow in the pathway. You would put direction on the graphs?
Yeah, I mean that
You're right.
But only one of the two outputs is ever on, and so there's a strong correlation between the input and the output.
You're right. You're right. The only problem is that not anti-correlation, just not correlation, but of even either. The problem is that we didn't have this information. You're absolutely right. The only reason we didn't do it and we took something like that is because we didn't have this information.
Why not?
Right. So what we did instead of that is we looked specifically at the main metabolic pathways. And the question we ask, is this just a property of the junction, or this also tells us something about the full metabolic pathway? Because this is just a linear, this is just a local analysis. The question is if we can see that it's really some function of the pathways. And we went through the metabolic pathway, and I want to show you some examples. Some of them will be apparent to you immediately, and some of them may be more interesting and more new, that we actually see this coming back in many metabolic pathways that we see on the level of pathways. So, for example, glycolysis is very interesting. Glycolysis, all the glycolysis pathway is strongly co-regulated. All the pathways, it's going from glucose to pyruvate, it's strongly co-regulated. However, pyruvate can go to fermentation, or it can go to TCA cycle. It's a junction point. As everyone would expect, only the part that goes to fermentation is co-regulated with glycolysis. And this is because when yeast use glycolysis, then they use it to go to fermentation, and only when they don't have glucose, then they do the TCA cycle. This is one example that we saw. Another example is in the purine de novo synthesis. So purine is one of the nucleotides that are used for synthesis DNA, and you can use either AMP or GMP. Purine is either AMP or GMP. Now, it turned out that this purine de novo synthesis you have here, I think like 6 or 7 genes, they are all very strongly co-regulated. However, they're only co-regulated when you look about the junction, the IMP is a junction point, it's only co-regulated with the part that goes to AMP and not with the part that goes to GMP. And one of the reasons, maybe I'll, if I don't know if I get time, I'll show, we think that this is because this is involved probably in, this can be used to generate ATP, and this is energy. So you can use it either as a nucleotide or as an energy source. This is another example. If you think about sulfur amino acid synthesis, sulfate can make homocysteine, which is a junction. It can either go to methionine or to cysteine. We see that it goes preferentially to cysteine. Ergosterol synthesis, acetyl-CoA can go to this intermediate. This intermediate can either go to ergosterol or to all these other metabolites. We see that all these pathways co-regulated, it goes here. In the TCA cycle, we see only subpart here is co-regulated. This is interesting. We see that acetyl-CoA goes something like that through the TCA cycle. This is in the pentose phosphate pathway. We see several interesting aspects. We see the ribose going to glycolysis is co-regulated. Those two genes are co-regulated with the glycolysis. Here we see something that goes to ribose. It's correlated with a gene that goes to PLPP, which then can be used to synthesize purine. So this is another example. So we see it also, and this is a counterexample. For example, when you make a trihalose and a glycogen, then in fact you have a junction point here, but everything is co-regulated. This is all induced during stress, and we see very strong co-regulation. So it looks like it's true. We should have done it properly on the local level by looking what's coming up, and we didn't have this information. But we do see it coming again and again on the level of actual pathway. The second thing that we asked is about this pathway. So that it's really, we get many of those that actually look something like this. And we ask, we have many junctions that are regulated by isozymes. So you can think about, if this is a metabolite, now the reaction here is regulated by isozymes. And the question that we ask, are those isozymes generally co-regulated? So they can be associated with the same pathway, with the same direction, or do we see differential? And again, you can think about three situations. One of them is that the two isozymes will be regulated with one particular output. One situation where only one isozyme will be chosen, and another one where each of the isozymes will actually be involved in a different pathways. And when we do the analysis of all of them, we see that actually what's chosen is C. Okay, so we have isozymes are generally differentially regulated with this sort of junction. And again, we ask, is this just a local observation, or is this something that we can also find in pathways? And again, we looked in many different pathways, and we saw this coming again and again. Glucose can go to glucose 6P, which can use to glycolysis or for storage. HXC2, one isozyme which regulated very strongly with glycolysis. Those two isozymes are co-regulated with a gene that goes to the storage. Glycogen and trihalose. Acetate can go to acetyl-CoA by ACS1 and ACS2. ACS1 is regulated very strongly with a gene that are going to this, with the pathway, the glycolysis cycle. This is with the aldosterone genes. You see that for the TCI cycle, we see almost three parallel pathways that go from pyruvate to alpha-ketoglutarate, which can go to three different subsequent. Here we also have an issue of localization, because some of this happen in the mitochondria, some of this in the peroxisome, et cetera. We have stress-induced isozymes, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I think that this is also what's actually happening. This is, I was told by someone, that in fact, what is known is that many times the feedback regulation of different pathway have feedback regulation on different isozymes. Okay, so this is actually something that someone told me that. So this is looks like it makes sense. So this is some few more examples. Yes. True.
So has it been done?
No, but that's a good idea. No. About isozymes? Maybe, but I don't know.
So more generally, looking at branching.
Okay, so I would be very happy to get the reference. I don't know. Very interesting. Okay. Now, another thing that we looked at is to see if when you incorporate functional data like co-expression, if you get differences in the topological structure properties. So we made the simple hypothesis that, which of course is not precise and not exactly, when you think about context dependent, two enzymes are expressed in the same context only when they are co-regulated. And again, co-regulation wasn't very strict. We took something that is about 0.25 correlation. And when you do this, you see that when you have all connection, you really get a very nice power law like was reported. However, when you screen and you only consider the connections that are co-expressed, then this power law actually moves to exponential. This is a linear and this is a log scale. Okay? So, it also modifies the structural properties. The second, okay, so what? What's all the way around? I did something wrong? What? But you have to look at the.
The linear scale on the left.
Yeah.
Large linear on the left.
Oh, I okay, so I messed up. It's the other way. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. One last point about this is we also looked. So we see that pathways are generally co-regulated. We see that co-regulation really can be used to define maybe the direction of flows. The next question that we ask is if we can see also some hierarchy in the modularity. And the way we did it is the following. Now, I didn't describe to you our method, but we devised new method that to identify what we call the transcription modules. So transcription modules is a self-consistent set of genes and conditions. So if you want, very simply put, it has genes and it has conditions. It has co-regulated genes and the co-regulating conditions. And the self-consistency means that you don't have any other gene in the genome that is more closely related to the genes and is not included. So it's a closed set. And there is a threshold here. And the threshold, the transcription module comes with a threshold, and the threshold tells you how strict is the co-regulation. And it's like a resolution parameter. When you think about low threshold, then you have loosely correlated modules, but they're still self-consistent. As you increase the threshold, you get a very strongly correlated module, and they are smaller. So the idea was to start with a metabolic pathway and to identify, if you want, the closest transcription module associated with them. They are not transcription modules. They are not self-consistent. But you can see what are the closest transcription modules that are associated with them. It's a function of threshold. And we can change the threshold, and we can see how it changes. And this will give us an hierarchy of modules. And I'll get into it. And what we saw something very interesting. We saw that you start with all the metabolic pathways. This is about 68 metabolic pathways. It's based on KED, but actually, Romain, the student who did it, had lots of literature search, and he refined all these modules. And what he said is that when you do this iteration, here you have the parameter of a threshold. Initially, you get lots of different transcription modules. But as you increase decrease the threshold, you get larger and more loosely correlated modules, everything converges to just three basic transcription modules. One of them is protein synthesis. It has all the ribosomal protein, everything that has to do with the cell growth. This, of course, wasn't included as our initial definition of pathway, but it came out in the iteration as the closest transcriptional module, amino acid biosynthesis, and stress. And when you look into each of these three, you see a very interesting thing, a thing that really makes biological sense and also maybe teaches new things. For example, if you look at the protein synthesis tree, you see that it has most of the function that has to do with rapid cell growth. Or at least, so what we have here is we have a parameter of the threshold. This is not a dendrogram, although it resembles a dendrogram. Each of these is a module, and they can overlap. It can have overlapping set of genes. And this is what we started with. And what you can see is that you have glycolysis and fermentation, which, of course, that's what you do when you grow very quickly. Then this converges into the ribosome. The ribosome proteins is a very strong module, it has all the ribosomal protein. Mannose converge here, cell structure, polarity, cell wall, the cell cycle, histone converge into the cell cycle, mannose converge. And interestingly, we got amino acid transport associated with this module. Remember, we have a whole tree about amino acid biosynthesis. We got a large group of amino acid transporters that actually were associated very strongly with the module of the protein synthesis. So they are induced during rapid cell growth together with the protein synthesis and not with the amino acid biosynthesis module. Now, in the module of the amino acid biosynthesis, we also got two amino acid transporters were associated with them. Those were usually the high affinity ones, and the other ones were lower affinity. So this is one of the observations. Question?
I want to try to understand better this, what you're actually doing. Okay.
Less stringent.
Less stringent?
Yeah, so you get more genes in. You get bigger modules.
Okay.
But they're always self-consistent. That's a defining property of them. They're always self-consistent. So you start with something which is very restrictive. So you only look for very, very strongly associated genes. That's your module. Yeah, exactly. And they are very functionally, the annotation, they're really very good. And
Okay. And one of the questions to give people like Lewis who may want to is, what's the correct one, right?
You're going to keep it loud.
I said, hate modules.
Sorry?
You were saying you hated modules.
I still do.
But one of the ways when you hate them or not, deciding whether it's a way to file it or not, if you have different objective ways of arguing or things or modules, and there's different objective ways to all line up.
Yeah.
I can understand if you took away the word module and used the word system or pathway, it makes sense. Module gives you a sense that you really have an isolated thing like a carburetor or something like that. And I'm afraid it's taking it easy. Can I just make a general point? I think it's very, very important for physicists to understand your first slide. Nothing makes sense other than in terms of evolution. In other words, evolution isn't a designer. In the sense that anybody is designing community pathways. It's an accretion of things, and so you have the history of how it evolved in these pathways. And that's why you don't have
them. Yeah, I guess I would say, I would say this.
We have our 2 o'clock discussion cut
out. Okay, so I just want to mention one thing regarding your point. Hierarchical modularity will also try to infer just based on structural data, and they found something different. I mean, there are differences. This is actually more functional. You see, like I said, you see the sphenolipids, for example, are associated with the protein synthesis, but the ergosterol is associated with the stress. So you
and
get the differences.
Each one of the boxes is a module?
Yeah, each one of the boxes is a module.
It determines the order of that arbitrary.
The order?
Yeah,
no, that's
along this axis.
Along this axis?
No.
Along this axis? This is a threshold.
So
it's a resolution parameter.
And the new models?
They converge to this one. When I take this module and I iterate, it's almost the same module. This and this are almost the same, maybe one gene less.
So
yeah.
So if you have a line that has no boxes on it, it wasn't part of any module.
Exactly. It means that this didn't converge to any module, it just disappeared. When it was iterated at this threshold, then I had to take it to this threshold in order for it to actually converge. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's the same model until here. And then it converges to this module, and this is a completely different module. In many cases, it doesn't even have this gene. So it's not a dendrogram. This is not included in this one. It's a different module. It just means that it's like a phase transition, right? You have a stable point here, a stable point here. When you change the temperature, this can sweep into here. That's basically what's happening here. Sometimes they both combine, but that's rarely. Usually what you get is you get a sweeping of something to another thing.
So in that module, you have part of the genes. Could you come back?
Yeah, sure.
In this crossing module, you have part of the genes in the phospholipid one, in the other one, in the copper and iron one. Right.
What do you mean again?
Well, just show one module. One of the crossing.
Okay, let's look at the. I don't know. You want to look at the electron transport chain?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Okay. Here.
That's one. Yeah.
Here you don't have any genes of the electron transport chain.
This model, you have all the genes of the electron transport chain.
Yeah, you have most of them. Yeah.
Plus other ones.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I can show you specific examples. What?
Well, then you lose some of them when you plump down the length.
Well, you actually, when you go from here to here, you actually lose almost all of them. They're just not part of the module. They're not part of the module. What happens is, I have a nice picture that's showing it for the glycolysis. You know, glycolysis is very strongly co-regulated. However, it's also connected to ribosomal protein. So if you start with high threshold, glycolysis is really a very good module because it's self-consistent, very nice. You start increasing the module, what happens? You start getting ribosomal protein coming in because they are correlated with the ribosomal protein, but not very well. But then the ribosomal protein come, and they bring all the friends together, in plurality glycolysis genes, because they are very strongly co-regulated and much stronger correlated between themselves than with the glycolysis gene. So that's what's happening. Yeah, that's a definition. This is our definition. I mean, you can agree with that or you don't need to agree with that. But that's a definition. And the defining property of each module is that it's self-consistent. That's what we describe. It's a self-consistent entity. Okay, so I'll just skip this last part and I'll just... I just want to acknowledge, so the first part that I told you about was done by Dor Sagi and Uri Shachar. Dor Sagi is the physics student who was working with Daniel Kandel in the physics department. Now he's working with Joel Stavans. Uri Shachar is a computer scientist. He's now working with me. So that's about this first part that I spoke about. The second part about the analysis of metabolic network was done by Ronen Levy, who's a master's student, and Jan Immers, who is a graduate student, is a physicist, working with me. Part of the analysis, Sven Bergman is also involved in the analysis, and the part that I wanted to talk about and I didn't speak about, it's done by Gilgi Friedlander. Okay, thank you.